Okay, insert into the finger of God.
I don't want it to be me again.
Adam, press the start button and let the finger decide.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Adam Sweet.
Thank you very much, and hello and welcome to the latest and greatest, most beautifully exquisite episode of Lug Radio. This is Season 5, Episode 3.
I'm so very excited, very excited. So excited, I've just popped one. Lovely, I desperately needed to know that.
A hemorrhoid.
So, who are we listening to?
Bad guys in Doctor Who.
I am Adam Sweet.
So what do you mean, the bad guys in Doctor Who?
When I was about six, I was convinced that the hemorrhoids were the bad guys in Doctor Who. My dad told me the sorry truth the one horrible day.
When one of his bum grapes popped out.
It was very unpleasant when he told me what a hemorrhoid was, I can tell you.
Lovely.
Sitting on your forehead.
moving swiftly on, yes.
So yes, you are Adam Sweet.
I am the fantastic Adam Sweet.
I am the less than fantastic Jono Bacon.
I am the extra fantastic Stuart Langridge.
And I'm the slightly dull Chris Proctor.
BSD.
Bored SD.
And this week on the show,
I talked to Kim Gill. That's Jill, isn't it? Kim Gill. About the Nokia
his
N810.
Right.
That's the Nokia N810.
Kim Gill, he's the best a man can get. Yeah, I've had a very exciting snot-driven episode of packaging.
Lovely. I want to know whether vendors should be liable for security holes in their products.
And we get fingered by God.
Is that just you?
That was a we.
That was weird.
That's, okay. That's all of us.
Personally, I found it enlightening.
And although, and less painful than I was expecting.
Okay, on the show now, we've got Kim Gill from Nokia and the MAMO project. How are you doing, Kim?
Very well, thanks.
Very good, very good, very good. Well, thank you for coming on to Lug Radio, and again. And so, obviously, there's been the announcement of the Nokia N810. So, would you like to, first of all, give us a quick overview of what the device has got in it? Why should we be excited?
Well, I think you should be excited because there's a third tablet, so I think it shows a line and a commitment and, you know, so some kind of solid purpose on all this project. And then, well, getting into details, I don't know if you're excited about hardware, keyboard and GPS. These are the two main novelties. In the software side, basically whatever comes new comes also new for the N800, so not really exclusive to the N810 only.
Okay, I was just wondering, obviously the iPhone has been released fairly recently, which has a fairly similar kind of feature set plus phone calls. Why would we want the N800? Sell it, or the N810 even. Sell it to me. Yeah. What advantage over the use of the iPhone, or why is it better than the iPhone?
Well, you can make calls with an iPhone, so that's, for some people that's really relevant. You can do many very interesting things with your fingers and the iPhone. And I guess you are going to be more successful in clubs and pubs with an iPhone as well.
Right.
So, yeah, go for it. If you are really into the full internet thing and, you know, just browsing websites as you are used to do with your laptop or whatever, PC, etc., if you enjoy like flash things and typing on a hardware keyboard now, etc., well, then perhaps you want to go for an internet tablet.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are into open source, I think the option is also clear. So most internet tablets are based on MIMO Linux, and this is 90% full open source, upstream, GNOME, Debian, whatever.
Sure. I noticed that, well, it doesn't seem to me that the N800 came out that long ago, so I wonder if you could tell us what it is that, why we have now have an 810, or what's improved in the 810 compared to the N800.
Just a comment. I don't know what happened to the microphone, but I cannot listen to you very well.
Hello, are you there?
Oh my God, that's much better.
Sorry about that. I was just wondering, it seems to me that the N800 didn't come out that long ago, so I wondered if you could tell us what the N810 does that the N800 didn't.
Well, yeah, basically, so it's I'm not really into like coding names and numbers. But basically, this additional 10 shows that it's not like a radical new generation, whatever. Yeah. I mean, it's a next step. So basically, in the inside, and you know, once you take out the box and you look at circuits, silicon, those kind of things, both devices are pretty similar. Really, the difference is that it has hardware keyboard that was one of the most required features, especially when you go out of the hardcore mobile or Linux people. I mean, if you go out to the street, people will tell you, yeah, very nice, but I mean, am I supposed to type there? So that's one thing. And then, well, GPS, because, I mean, it's getting in all the, you know, it's getting in all the like, smartphone or high-end mobile phones, and etc. So we are getting this as well, and this opens a, well, a lot of possibilities for doing things. You could connect already to a GPS via Bluetooth, but of course having it integrated just feels much better. So I'm looking forward for these applications and web awareness, that when you post things, they're automatically saying where you are, or all these kind of things that we are getting more and more. So these are the two main differences.
Yeah. What's your job title at Nokia?
My what?
Your job title.
Oh, yes. I'm product manager of the MIMO development platform.
Oh, yeah, I thought so. You're MIMO rather than, you know, Nokia open source as a whole. At the moment, we're seeing MIMO appear on the internet tablets, which is great. But are we likely to see that kind of thing start appearing on Nokia phones as well? Because, as Chris said, one of the big things that I've got a phone, I carry it around every day, and that's fine, but I don't really have space in my pocket for a phone and an N800 or an N810 and my cigarettes. So, so I'm afraid the N810 has to go. But I'd love to be able to get a phone from Nokia, which is running open source software. Is that on the cards anywhere? Are you talking to the rest of Nokia about that, or is the internet tablet project a bit out on its own?
All right, so we have here like Mohammed and the Mountain. We have two possibilities here. So either you get a cellular to a tablet with Linux, or you get Linux to like mobile phones. No, these are more or less the two ways we have.
Yeah.
There's no official plans about none of this, but what is true is that, I mean, Nokia, I don't know, it's not doing this just for fun, you know?
So, yeah.
this is our platform. It's getting more awareness inside and outside this huge company at every iteration. In this sense, the N810 and MIMO Chinook is a big step forward. I don't know, Forum Nokia, I don't know if you know about Forum Nokia. I didn't know about Forum Nokia myself before joining this company. But basically, it's a huge platform for supporting developers. They have like 3.5 million registered users. Okay, maybe some of them, they are not active all the time, but still, just take a fraction of that, and there's plenty of people there. And just yesterday, MIMO's officially supported there as well.
Yeah.
With all this, what I want to say is that, well, we are doing steps. And of course, if MIMO Linux just happens to be a good platform, solid, bringing third-party applications and all that, well, I guess at some point it will come. The only thing is that compared to, 2003, 4, 5, those years where this platform started, on that time, cellular and you know, making phone calls and etc. Were something that I guess it will be different in, I don't know, 1, 2, 3, 4 years, no idea, you know. So only for instance, only to give you an example, it is already known that the next device will come with WiMAX in it. This WiMAX is like a VLAN, but like super duper turbo or something. So basically you get like a whole VLAN cloud on top of your city, and wherever you move you are online.
Yeah.
Well, when you are inside one of these clouds, like in, I don't know, Birmingham, just to provide an example, and you don't move of your bloody city in you know, 90% of the time, then basically if through Gizmo or SIP calls or Skype or whatever you're using, you can do all those calls. So one day, if one day, what I want to say is that if one day this cellular comes finally to the tablets, or the other way around, or Linux will go to the mobile phones, probably that day we will not find that thing as exciting as it would have been felt by, let's say, 770 users.
Last year. No, I can see that. I mean, I know about Forum Nokia because I've been doing Python programming on S60, which is what my phone runs. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that MIMO has ended up there. But, I think the VoIP thing, now that it does Skype and SIP VoIP now, yes, the N800 and the N810, I think.
Yeah. So now with MIMO Chinook, you will get this SIP functionality that, well, is based on the telepathy framework and the SOFIA project, and, well, all these technologies are open source, and actually they are developed by people, you know, UK-based. They are doing, these people from Collabora, they are doing a great job on those technologies. So, yes, we have the successful brands like Skype, yes, bad guys, software works. And then we also have the open source alternatives, so for developers and everybody to play with. So I think fair enough.
Yeah.
Sure. I was just wondering, I know that MIMO's it's an open platform. I just wondered if you could tell me how rich the third-party application development is, because one thing, following on from Chris earlier, he asked you what advantage the N800 and the N810 have over an iPhone. The first thing that sprung into my mind is the fact that it's an open platform and other people can develop for it. So are there many other applications being developed?
Well, I would say yes. I don't have exact numbers now, but mm-hmm. if you go to garage.mimo.org, you will see around 300 projects and around 5,000 people registered. Wow. There. I'm not saying all of them, they are like developing like beta state applications and etc. Yeah. But well, I mean, there's activity in it. So from a developer point of view, the tablet, it's at the very end, GNU Linux mm-hmm. System with, you know, with the Debian tools and GNOME desktop, this is what you get. And then you get some things that are specific to the tablet, with Hilden desktop that, of course, is more focused on a smaller mm-hmm. form factor and touchscreen and such things. But, I mean, if you're developing, for instance, for any GNOME-based desktop, jumping to MIMO isn't that difficult for you.
Sure. One final question just before we wrap up. I wasn't sure. Is the N810 out now or is it coming soon?
Well, yes. So mid-November, something like that. Right, okay. It should be in the shops. So, yeah,
sure.
Pretty soon.
So, this was a leading question, by the way. So, let me assure you that when you start sending out test units for review, I'd be quite
a Lug Radio one would be good.
Yes, well, all four. So, anyway, thank you very much for coming on the show. And take care. We hope to speak to you soon.
No, thanks very much.
I think it's safe to say, you know, over the years, we've been doing this for a while now, that Lug Radio has become a medium for the transferal of wisdom.
I think there are a few people that would agree with you there, but proceed.
I will continue. And as bastions of wisdom, I think that it's fairly safe to say that we have become reputed on the internet and in the open source community as being fairly scholarly.
Reputed for something, anyway.
But so, we, as four scholarly, wise men, also handsome, we sometimes find it difficult to make decisions, right? We sometimes find it difficult to define the one true outcome of a particular debate. Sometimes it can result in myself and old sausage fingers having the argument to change here and there.
Oh, that's me, isn't it? Thanks.
So based on the preceding premise...
So based on this premise, you know, we've been looking for a higher force, a greater good in which we can come to some conclusion. And we have...
Unfortunately, communitizing the community source for the benefit of the community was already taken.
But we have found such a force. And of course it is...
The Lug Radio Finger of God.
Before us sits the Lug Radio Finger of God. And I'm sure you'll sit there thinking...
What the fuck is the Lug Radio Finger of God? And I will tell you, it's essentially a box that Jono picked up for the princely sum of 20 quid. Into which we all insert a finger.
Or other appendage of our choice.
We've tried it, listeners.
And then it waits for a bit, and then randomly electrocutes one of us.
I personally am very, very afraid.
We've all got pretty sweaty palms.
I have, actually. And at least one of us has already been to the bathroom to release himself in advance.
Okay, kids, so here's the game, right? I'll nominate a subject. You all pick your favourite thing in that subject, in that category. You get one sentence to justify it. And then the finger of God decides.
I am actually scared, you know.
I'm quite scared as well.
I was a bit scared at the paintball the first time we did it in real life. But I'm really scared now.
Yeah, the thing is, if something bad happens to me unexpectedly, I sometimes tend to squeal like a girl. And I'm quite afraid of doing that.
I'll be honest with you, the Lug Radio Brown factor is quite high here in the studio. But let's give it a go. So, are we ready? Your first category.
Hold on. Where are we starting? Which direction?
We will start, I will start with, Monsieur Bacon.
Okay, it's
and
gone
we'll
off.
Go, and we'll go clockwise.
The finger of God has an automatic shutdown, it seems.
Oh, let's press buttons and see, there we go, we're okay. Right, everything's okay.
It is working, okay.
Oh my God.
People, I'll nominate a category. You get one sentence and no damn sentence with millions of ands in it either. One ordinary sentence.
Not a great
You can't just
sentence.
Get an entire essay and string it together with the word but. Right? One sentence. Right. Your subject is male clients. Mr. Bacon, nominate your male client and give one sentence in its defence.
Evolution. A controversial choice.
End of sentence.
Okay.
You only get one sentence.
The finger will decide.
My male client of choice is Thunderbird because I find it very fast, and also because I hate evolution because everything's too large and it weighs too much real estate on not showing male. Gmail, I can't find any male in it if you have to search for it, and Kmail, I haven't used in a very long time, and everything else stinks of shit.
That's a long sentence.
Okay.
That's good, isn't it?
Okay. Chris?
Kmail, does it deals with email and does nothing else. It does what it does, and it does it well.
Okay, and mine is Gmail.
Feel the freedom. Sorry.
Because I can get it from everywhere, including work, which is where I actually need to read half my mail from.
I'm more free than you. Excellent.
Insert your finger in the Lug Radio Finger of God.
I use my other hand, which hasn't got a watch.
The Lug Radio Finger of God. I'm very carefully sitting with my feet raised off the ground. Okay, so
really press the butch.
Adam, would you like to depress the start button?
Here we go.
And let the Finger of God decide.
I don't want it to be me.
I'm really scared. This is terrifying.
Right, Adamski.
Okay,
we have officially proved that Thunderbird is the best mail client.
Thank you very much, I knew
moving
already.
Moving on, people, programming editors. We'll go this way around this time. So, Chris, your programming editor of choice.
Emacs, because it does everything, and it does it well.
Including video editing. Shut up.
Sorry, carry on.
Many people might laugh at my choice, but my choice of text editor is MC Edit, which comes as part of Midnight Commander, because it's really fucking easy, and I live on the command line at work.
Bacon?
My choice is going to be Eclipse. I think it's a very complete, and even though it starts fairly slowly, very complete and powerful editor that supports various languages, and most importantly, Python, which I pretend to do.
Sort of a cock.
And my choice is gedit, because it's there on every desktop I need, and it does everything that I need it to. I don't need all your flashy code folding shite, because it's all pointless. Okay, insert into the finger of God.
I don't want it to be me again.
Adam, press the start button.
And let the finger decide. We should know that this is on hardcore setting as well.
Yeah, there are two settings. There's wimpy, you'll be okay setting, and death by electrocution. Here it comes.
Don't be me again.
How long?
It's taunting us.
Motherfucker!
So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen.
Right, thank you very much. Gedit for everybody, no more Emacs. And our final choice of subject is the best kind of music. We'll let Adam go first this time.
I don't really have a very good reason, but my favourite kind of music is punk music, particularly The Clash and The Sex Pistols and Stiff Little Fingers. I've been listening to it since I was about 15.
Okay, bacon, surprise us.
Metal. And I'm going to explain it with this sentence. Metal, 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 metal. If you're not into metal, you're not my friend. Thank you.
Chris? I'm an indie kid because I live in a very big house in the country.
You pots, honestly. And I like hip-hop because it's the best music and all of you lot are wrong.
And you're, so, you've got that suspension on your car and the bounces when you go up and down.
I have, it's wicked. I really have. I need to get some of them spinners. Right, okay. Let the finger of God decide the best kind of music.
This is worse for me and Chris because we haven't been zapped by the God finger.
Okay. The finger decides. I'm always prepared to put up with the pain, just as long as it's not metal.
In bitter irony, he's probably going to get it, and metal will be the best music of all.
I'm willing to suffer for metal.
No, I'm not!
I don't want it to be me again.
Damn!
It's fixed! It's fixed, I tell you!
Metal wins.
Metal will live forever.
Right, okay. So having done that, I think we ought to get Chris to put all of his fingers in all of the holes.
Yes, come on, in all the holes, Christopher.
Come on, Christopher.
Come on.
New boy. No, near the microphone.
I can't reach near the microphone.
I'll move the microphone.
Move the microphone, yeah. Okay,
I think this is a little unfair. It was an arbitrary statement.
Works better.
Okay, press the start button.
This is for whether window maker is the best window manager, obviously.
More of a dick. Chris, or Chris.
Unfortunately, two fingers are missing, so...
So he might not get zapped at all.
And...
Waiting. Hurry up, man.
Your zapping is important to us.
It waits to make you fear it.
Oh.
He didn't do it then, did it to you?
No.
Let's let Chris... stew until the next one.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, thank you very much. The Lug Radio Finger of God, ladies and gentlemen.
Send us your suggestions for topics for the Finger of God. And
next week we may have read the manual and figured out how to do that.
And you can listen to your favourite presenters getting electrocuted.
Yeah, you can actually assign your viewpoint to a presenter if you want.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
That's a good idea.
Yep, so send us in your suggestions to show@lugradio.org and we'll ask the Finger of God to decide.
The world is full of fucked up computers, right?
Yep.
Right?
Yep. Agreed.
Everyone agrees. It's agreed. A good start.
Is that because they're running the herd?
No. Because no computers are running. No. The important point here is that you've got a lot of Windows machines out there which are improperly secured. You've got a lot of Linux machines out there that are improperly secured. There are worms going around the internet. There's Code Red or what have you. There's the Storm Worm at the moment. Machines in botnets, all this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And one solution that people have suggested, I've seen Bruce Schneier suggest it among other people, is that software vendors...
It must be true then.
It's a suggestion. The suggestion is that software vendors should be held responsible, legally responsible, for security holes in their products. So if you sell someone an operating system or a database server or something, and that gets compromised, any damages that are caused from that are the responsibility of the person who wrote the software, the company that wrote the software.
Right.
That's the idea.
Right.
Instinctive reaction to this is to say, well, that's a shit idea. But part of the reasoning behind it, the reason given for this, is precisely so that vendors really will give a toss about security. They won't try and bury. You see this kind of argument a lot in places that believe in full disclosure for security issues, where vendors won't try and bury or hide security issues, and you'll know that things will be properly tested before they get released. And there'll be we've moved now towards a world in which when you buy a computer, it's more secured by default. It's not shipped with lots and lots of ports open, but there's still a long way we could go on that. This would instantaneously solve that problem.
It's interesting because, of course, when you go out and buy a product, you know, there's a certain amount of safety and responsibility built into that product. We're sat here, and the most immediate thing I can see in this room is my tumble dryer. And, you know, when we went out and bought that tumble dryer, of course, you know, if the thing bit my head off.
realistically, if it exploded and burned down your house.
Yeah.
In all honesty, imagining its contents, I think it's highly likely. Been there a while, I suggest.
Exactly. I mean, the manufacturers, who I shouldn't name, but who I'll say are Indesit, would be liable. If it caught fire and burned your house down the day after you bought it, Indesit would be liable.
But that's
that.
The thing, and should software be different? But there seems to be a different thing for software in the fact that, if there's a security hole, well, that's just kind of fact of life, really.
I think this idea has been bouncing around for a long time. I think most Microsoft critics have probably been saying for maybe 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years even. Wow, I can count really fast, can't I? between 5 and 10 years, a lot of people saying, well, if a car crashed as often as Windows does, then we'd all be fucked. And yeah. I think there's two things to me stick out here. First of all is, I think if software manufacturers were liable, first of all, we'd have a lot less code and a lot less PCs on desks. But also, what we had would be a lot more stable because people wouldn't be pushing it out the door to hit the deadlines. They'd be making sure it was ready to go instead of trying. I'm picking on Microsoft here, but I think a lot of people think that Microsoft get the product out of the door, broken or not, and try and fix it afterwards.
But I wonder. Sorry, go ahead.
I think you've kind of hit on the major reason why people want this is they want to bash Microsoft. Mm-hmm. So I think there's actually, when you look at it from an open source point of view, there's actually real issues we're trying to do this. Like Ubuntu, if there's a bug in the kernel that's a security hole, and you've supplied me my copy of Ubuntu. Is it Ubuntu's fault? Is it the kernel programmer's fault?
Right.
Who is really to blame? I mean, the kernel programmers have written the code, so presumably they wrote the bug, or they left the bug open, but Ubuntu have supplied it to me.
If I was to provide an answer as me and not necessarily Ubuntu, I'd say that it's the distribution's responsibility.
Do they have to security test every single line of code in the entire distribution?
Because I'd say that you get your software from the distributor, you don't get your software from the upstream project, and distributors patch.
A more interesting question as regards open source is, let's take Know My River, which Jono wrote, right, or Cruciform, which I wrote recently. That's a good example because it's on the web. Tiny little forum system. If there's a security hole in that, I've released that as open source software. If I was financially liable for security holes, I probably wouldn't have released it.
This is a product
I have no money. I have no backup fund. The argument here is not that everyone ends up on the hook for it. It just means that if you're a software producer, you basically buy insurance against it. It's not as if you're personally on the hook and you have to sell your house for it. Software companies will buy insurance against this. At that point, it becomes a manageable risk. People can sit there and weigh up the cost-benefit analysis of security. At the moment, if there's the only deficit to shipping products with security holes is a PR benefit, a PR deficit. You know, it looks bad for you if your product's full of holes, because then people might not buy the next
version. Well, I was going to say, that should
be... But other than that, there's no real other reason why you shouldn't put out a product with holes in. This is a way of getting people to actually think about security as an item on the balance sheet, you know?
I think the thing is as well, I mean, the issues that it raises in my mind is, one, given the industry that we've got right now where you don't have to be, where you're not liable for security holes in general purpose software, obviously for specific installations you would be, would the industry have developed as quickly?
Well, wouldn't everybody just be sitting around going, oh, well, I can't release this until...
You could say that.
I can be 100% entirely sure that there were no security holes.
But then again, the people do Indesit and other tumble dryer manufacturers, has their industry developed very, very quickly, despite the fact that they do have this responsibility? That's one question I'd ask. And the other thing is, given the industry that we've got today, where it is liable, people should be deciding on manufacturers based upon their record, their track record for security. And I think that's the reason that, Microsoft were massively hammered on security, and they've, in their credit, they've done...
They have smartened up their act.
They've smartened up their act quite considerably. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know, it's like... it's one of those pipe dreams, isn't it?
Well, I think two things might come out of this. First of all is that I think it might put a lot of smaller software manufacturers, push them back into their little holes, and maybe we wouldn't have such a diverse community. I'm not talking about the Linux community here. I'm just talking about smaller software developers.
I think you're over-exaggerating the effect it would have. I mean, pick an example. If you go out and buy medical insurance, right? then it will cost you, what, £30 a month for you to be insured for me. I don't know what it's like in the States, but here in the UK, if you get private medical insurance, it costs you £30 or £40 a month, probably.
Yep.
And then if you end up having to have an incredibly expensive private operation that costs £100,000, you are covered. So right. It's not as if you're a software company and you end up on the hook for damages, you're not going to be paying all of your money out because insurance helps you manage risk. And there's a reasonably profitable business in being an insurer in this game.
But you've still got to pay the insurance premiums on that. If you're a small company, then you've got to find the money. It depends how much the insurance premiums are.
And what about open source software?
It does.
And I have no money.
Yeah, and I've got no realistic way of predicting what an insurance premium would be.
What I was thinking about that is that I would imagine, if you're talking about insurance premiums, I'd imagine they'd be pretty high because it's almost inevitable that there are going to be security flaws found in software.
I was going to say, then again,
it might make people more proactive in doing the self-healing network kind of idea where SE Linux or AppArmor or similar solutions where if there is a security flaw found in the software, you've already got a proactive system behind it that stops it destroying the system.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point is not that they say if we find a security hole in your product by sitting there and examining it, we will fine you £100,000. That's not how it works. It's you're on the hook for damages caused by the security. So if I've got Cruciform on a server, right, and there's a security hole in it, but that server had SE Linux on it, and so it couldn't get any further, then there would be no damages caused, and therefore I wouldn't be liable for anything. But it's not a fine.
But in terms of the
software vendor is responsible for the damages, rather than the company who bought the software having to stuff up and pay it out of their own pocket.
But in terms of not wanting to derail this discussion too much towards insurance, but is it even insurable? Because
it's inevitable.
Because the thing is, if there was that kind of system in place, essentially. The reason why we buy insurance is that, you know, if something does go wrong, that you will be covered. You know, if insurance companies never paid out, you'd never get insurance. You'd just take the risk. And the thing is that if you had this system whereby an insurance company is only going to insure you, they want to know their level of risk. Yes. And the software is so massively complicated. How would they assess that level of risk?
That's what an actuary does. For a living.
Sure.
In exactly the same way that they have to assess your ability to drive.
Sure, but I don't know, just something in me says that software development as a subject is, and all the variables involved in it is so complicated.
But the thing is, think about cars, right, back to the car analogy. The thing is, most cars systems are computer operated these days. Your fucking brakes.
Yeah. Fuel injection, ABS. Engine management, yeah.
Perhaps a full operating system and your system services and so on and your end-user software. That is an infinitely more complex system.
Mm.
But for that argument,
it doesn't really matter because if the software in my car fails and I crash, the car vendor is liable because it's their product that failed.
They don't
get to get out of it because they say, oh, it wasn't the hardware that failed, it was the engine management system.
Well, what I was going to say is, if that level... Surely, I was going to say, car software systems have to be so incredibly well-tested before you can even put a car near a real human.
But that may only have one function.
That's a bespoke piece of software for a specific vehicle. I mean, if you take something like Windows or Linux, which is supposed to run on thousands of different devices and thousands of different contexts.
A general purpose operating system.
I just wonder if it's
insurable. Paradigmatically, all risks are insurable in one way or another.
Paradigmatically? What the fuck?
That's a £4.50 word for late at night.
You've got one of those calendars with a fucking special word on for every new day.
It's my word of the day.
So, I've got, what I was going to say is then, if you say Code Red 2 happens tomorrow,
yeah,
this to me, I think, would shaft Microsoft right up the backside. I was going to say it would do.
At the same time as it shafted everybody else, basically.
Well, if it happened for Linux, it would shaft all the Linux.
Well, that's it.
I think if this thing came in, basically, the Linux community largely wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
And
on the other hand, we'd have decent, secure software
that's closed source.
Well, this is why I was heading.
And expensive.
Why would it be closed source necessarily?
Because I can't.
Because somebody has to be responsible for the end of the day to pay those insurance premiums.
And
they have to make money out of it, so they don't...
But why wouldn't Canonical or Novell or Red Hat be in that position? You've got money.
They could theoretically, yes, free software companies could theoretically take out the insurance. But I think I'm not so much talking about the companies. I'm talking about regular Joes and Josephines who want to make free software.
But importantly, what you said is that end users get their software from the distributor.
Yeah.
Which means that the distributor's liable. So if I write some software, I just make sure that basically you get it through a distributor. Essentially, I can imagine...
How could you make it available through a distributor?
I can imagine, because I don't offer it for downloads on my website. I just send Canonical patches every time.
But then it's free software, and somebody else who's not a distributor could offer it.
Absolutely, and if someone else wants to take it from Ubuntu and offer it themselves, then they're prepared to assume the risk, because they then become the distributor.
I think so.
Instead of then punting it out on the internet and just, if distros like it, they'll download it, you have to go around all the distros and pimp your own software through certain channels.
You have to
ring up Mr. Shuttleworth and say, please.
And that's fundamentally not free.
I can imagine a company setting up whose sole job is to act as distributors to assume the risk in return for something.
But it's not free software.
I think this would destroy people's willingness to commit a patch.
Yeah, absolutely.
I agree with you completely.
Yeah, sure.
Incidentally, I have to say, I mean, I'm not defending the idea. I'm saying that the idea has been brought up.
Mm-hmm. I think
about the effect it would have on the open source community.
I do think it would really make a big difference, though, in so much as I said before, I think it would force people to develop proactive systems that will limit the risk of any security damage. Sorry, limit the damage of any security risk before it even happens, say, SE Linux and AppArmor. Yeah. And I think something like that Microsoft could very well do with.
Well, the thing is, I mean, you could theoretically say for companies that are selling a piece of software. So when you sell a piece of software, you essentially enter into a contract with that company, that this rule would apply to them.
No.
But I'm not saying for any second that this is the way it would work, but I'm just saying that if you said that a company that sells software, and that could include a company that sells a version of Linux or whatever, that they take on that responsibility, but for people who produce free software that's distributed freely on the internet, it couldn't. But I think the two are incompatible, and it would kill the free software world, so...
I have to say, agree with you.
Yeah.
A couple of days ago, I had cold. Terrible, terrible cold, right?
Oh, as opposed to wind for a change.
It was terrible, terrible cold. The thing I've discovered about cold, right? When you have a cold, you've basically got two perks to the job, okay? You've got a cold. One perk is that you get sympathy, okay? And the problem
from who?
Well, if you've got a cold, you should theoretically get sympathy, you know? And the one thing I've discovered is that us fellas, we don't get sympathy, our cold is called man flu.
Yeah, I had to go and make my own Lemsip last time I had a cold.
The fucking sisterhood of that. They've constructed this term called man flu.
You know, so let's go, he's got man flu.
Oh, he's just got a dose of man flu.
So, do you know what? I stab him in the eye.
I really imagine this segment going in a different direction.
The second perk is that you might pass on your disgusting disease onto somebody else and get a certain amount of bizarre satisfaction. And for some reason, no one can catch my cold. Anyway!
That's because you work from home.
That's because you caught it off a pig.
So anyway,
that wasn't the cold.
So anyway, I had cold the other night and I went to bed and I couldn't sleep. And I hate laying in bed and I hate, not in general, but I hate laying in bed and not being able to sleep. So I always just get up and just start doing something. I thought, I'll work during the night.
Yeah, but you do.
Yeah. So anyway, I thought to myself, I'll learn
how to... My hand looks rosy this evening.
I'll learn how to package. As most people do think when they're ill. For a while now, I've been taking more of an interest in packaging, and some of the work that we're doing in the community team at Ubuntu is to try and improve more people doing packaging. But I'd never actually done it, so I thought, I'll have a go.
Right, correct me if I'm wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've got a big fucking stiffy about packaging at the moment, right?
A little
bit. Didn't you used to think it was really boring?
No, that's source control.
Now, hang on. There are two things here. First of all, you did used to think it was really boring. And secondly, I still do think it's really boring. But carry on. Tell us about your fascinating adventures of depackage.
So anyway.
I can't wait.
So it's fun in the sun. So anyway,
Your daddy took the T-bird away, didn't he?
I was basically thinking, okay, I'll have a crack at packaging, and in the true spirit of sharing experiences and stories with each other and electrocuting ourselves on the show, I thought I'd tell you about it. Depackage is actually quite interesting, and packaging is actually quite interesting, believe it or not.
I'm inclined to believe you. I think thousands wouldn't.
The thing that fascinates me, I don't know why I'm fascinated by packaging, but...
Excuse me, I'm just looking up chin.lugradio.org.
The thing that fascinates me is that you've got all of these different bits and pieces that fit together. So, you know, you've got this complex chunk of source code, and I'm only talking about the Debian packaging system because I have no idea of how RPM works. So it can probably do all of this stuff as well. But with Depackage, you've got this piece of software, and then you patch it a little bit, and then you create a source package. And then from that source package, you can create a binary package. And then all the dependency stuff obviously is figured out and all the rest of it. And the thing I like about it is it's actually a very, very elegant system. And the fact that you take your tarball. So I took Pitavi. 0.11.0.0.1.pig that's just come out recently.
CVS plus one.
And I took that, and then I used... The great thing is, because there's a load of packages out there already, I could take some of the control files from there and then look at how they work, and then I could create my source package. And then from that, I could really easily create a binary package. And the thing is, you use a thing called a P-Builder, which basically...
Builds a P. that's Matthew P. Builder.
That's almost as good as Herb Nerb, wasn't it? Herb Nerb. The Finnish biscuit.
Should we clarify what our in-joke is there?
Sorry. Yeah,
explain.
Sweet. All right, as part of the sound check when we were about to interview somebody, we asked them what they had for breakfast. And
Kim Jill
was saying that he had cookies and milk. And we were like, so that's like some kind of Finnish biscuit, or is it like digestives or hobnobs? And I came out with herb noobs for Finnish hobnobs.
Finnish for... Hobnobs. Herb noobs. So I don't know why that was so funny, but it was very entertaining.
Back to packaging.
So anyway, the thing about this P-Builder is it basically constructs it's like a blank Debian system. So when you build your package, it will pull in the dependencies each time. So
it creates a whole chart.
Yeah, and it's just...
So it actually figures out the dependencies for you?
So
do you have to list them?
In the package, you basically specify the dependencies that your package requires, right?
Right.
But when you... This is the source package, right? But when you actually build it, and you type in one command to build it with the P-Builder, the P-Builder will look at your package, and it will download all the dependencies inside this Chroot environment, and then install them in the right order, and then run your package.
There are a load of little... the nice thing about building a Debian package is it's actually quite a complicated process, but people have gradually automated each of the steps, and then combined all the automated steps together into something, into another program. So there's a little program called DH Schlibdeps, I think, which works out your shared library dependencies for this package. I think that's what it does. And there's one called DH Make, which does something similar with a make file.
There's the one called Flurgle Flurgle Burger.
There is Flurgle Flurgle Burger. Should it be DH Flurgle Flurgle Burger?
Is there an Erstburger?
Yeah, I mean, they've... an Erstburger. So they've gradually built up this little library of tiny programs that do a little bit of the Debian packaging system, and then combined all that together into... So essentially you end up running one command. It runs all these other commands. It builds your whole Debian package. And
so to outline the process in a nutshell, I followed the Ubuntu packaging guide, which is on the Ubuntu wiki, and basically it shows you how to do it, first of all, essentially manually, where you have like a make file and you specify all the different bits and how it builds, right? And that's quite complicated. And then the next step shows you how to use something called Deb Helper, which basically... automates a bunch of these things, such as installing the documentation files and these other bits and pieces, right? And it like cuts the file down massively. And then there's another thing called the CDBS, which is the Common Debian Build System, I think it stands for, something like that. Yeah. And that cuts it down even further. So when I looked at the Pitavi control file for the from the sample package, the current package in Ubuntu, there was like five lines in there or something. It's really, really simple, and it's just the part of the reason why I'm interested in it is the fact that So much depends on packaging in any distribution. And obviously with Ubuntu and Debian, you've got these, like Ubuntu Universe and Debian's main package archives, you've got these thousands of packages.
Yeah.
And the fact that you've got things like, the tools are there to make it relatively straightforward to go through. It's not by any means a really simple process, but you don't have to be a programmer, you don't have to be anything particularly hardcore. You can do this, and then of course you can use something like PPA, which is Personal Package Archives, which allows you to build it for different archives.
I've got a slightly boring technical question for you. You know when you compile something from source, right, it ends up in user local,
yep.
And then it's own, maybe sometimes it's whatever, bin, whatever, or yeah. It ends up in its own directory. Do you have to pass the, when you're preparing to create your packages, do you have to pass a great big fucking bunch of configure options to say install the libs into user lib?
You specify the location in with when you do it manually and with Deb Helper, I think. Actually, with Deb Helper, you might not, but with the CDBS thing, you don't do any of that.
All right, so it goes in the user bin, user I mean, lib, user...
To be frank, I mean, part of the reason why I'm doing this is because I'm being bullied into being a Motu in the Ubuntu world.
Master of the universe.
Yeah, Motu is basically the team that looks after Universe, which is an archive, which is basically mm-hmm. the Debian archive built for Ubuntu. And I wanted to learn more about it anyway, but because I'm working with Daniel and he looks after Motu, does a lot of work on Motu.
This is entirely unfair on you, unfortunately, Jono Baker, but I'm going to pimp on your behalf, right? Apologies, everybody. This is the Ubuntu show. well, first of all, there's the Personal Package Archives on Launchpad. You can talk about that if you want to. And I believe OpenSUSE are doing a similar thing.
Yeah,
build your own packages. But also, isn't it Ubuntu Open Week next week and there's some packaging...
It is, yeah.
...things on IRC?
So this show's released on Monday, which will be the first day of Ubuntu Open Week, and there's like 7 or 8 sessions on packages. There's actually some tuition sessions, two-hour sessions.
I've read some stuff on packaging. I've always liked to be able to do it, but I've never actually gotten around to it because I've never had to install some packages that weren't in the repositories on enough machines to make it worthwhile, but I might join in.
At this moment, I really feel I ought to pimp RPM, but unfortunately there's so fucking little documentation about it. I can't actually tell you anything to look at, but it kind of seems simpler to me in some ways.
I've never looked at RPM, but the thing I was going to say was the thing that stunned me about it, and I've only scratched the surface, was that I expected it to be really, really complicated to do packaging. And I was stunned how easy it to produce a package.
I found RPM to be kind of, it was really, really, really complicated until you got your head around it and suddenly it all just clicked. And yeah, at that moment,
you have the moment,
okay,
of
that made sense.
Enlightenment. I mean, the interesting thing I think about Debian packages is that the process is complicated, but because the sorts of people who are doing it a lot are the sorts of people who understand the process in depth, they've sat there and they've built tools that every time they've gone, this is complicated, they've thought, this is complicated, so I'm going to write a fucking piece of Perl to do it for me so I don't have to do it. And then eventually all those little bits of Perl have ended up into a thing where you can type 5 commands and it creates a package. The question I have, there's quite a lot of politics around Debian packaging and how to do it. Like, there are people who believe that you shouldn't use Deb Helper, and there are people who believe that you shouldn't use CDBS.
Yeah.
Have you got involved with that?
The only thing...
Have you basically gone, CDBS makes it easy, I'm using CDBS, and ignored the people who say you shouldn't use it because X, Y, and Z?
I have a story about this. In the Ubuntu packaging guide, it shows you how to package GNU Hello, which is just a little Hello World, which is used as an example. Hmm. But my first proper package was Pitavi. And I'm going to be quite frank in the fact that I basically stole most of the contents of the Debian directory from the Pitavi package and then modified it with all the rest of it. That uses CDBS, right? When I did that, and I mentioned it in the channel, in the Ubuntu-Motu channel, a couple of people said, you know, oh, some Debian people might kind of take the piss out of you about CDBS. And it sounds like basically CDBS is essentially a numpty's way of doing it. And Deb Helper is something that people legitimately tend to use for who've been doing a lot of packaging for a long time. And then the hardcore will do everything manually.
Right.
That's the impression I get. Bear in mind that all of this that I'm saying has the caveat of I've done one evening of this.
Yeah. But next question then. Completely different question. Not a technical one as such. Imagine I didn't give a shit about the community. So I'm not interested in making packages for other people to download. Right. If I wanted PTV 0.11, and I downloaded it. Is there any reason why I should build a package for myself and install that package rather than just install it in user local?
I wouldn't say so. Well,
is the only reason to build packages because you want to contribute into the distribution or to make something available to other people? You're basically not doing it for your own benefit. You're doing it because you want to offer something.
Well, I was going to say, I'd say that when it's a package, the upgrade path is clearer.
My problem with that, I understand that absolutely. If I package 0.11 and then later on Ubuntu package 0.11, then it'll neatly upgrade from my one to their one. But that's only if I make sure that the version number in mine is less than the version number in the Ubuntu world, which means I've got to spend ages thinking about how Ubuntu are going to do something in the future so it fits in. Otherwise, my crappy PTV package will override the nicely built proper Ubuntu one, and I don't want to take that risk.
I think that added, obviously deploying software is easier as well, to a degree. I mean, I know people who set up their own.
Not really. Typing dpackage-i mypitiv.deb is no more difficult than typing make install pitiv.
No, I'm talking about deploying on multiple machines.
Well, that was one of my reasons. I think the two reasons I can think of why you'd want to do it is, first of all, geek cred, because it's fucking... You feel like you've earned some points there, I'd say. It's like building your own kernel for the first time.
I was well pleased.
Well, one of those things that where you think this is a really good idea, and then 5 years later you realise, I don't have to do this. What crap idea that was.
Well, the other thing was...
It seems to be very much like building your own kernel, to be honest with you. It used to give you geek cred, and now you'd think, why would I want to do that? It's a crap idea.
The only other reason why I can think you'd want to do it is if you've got enough machines where it's worth spending the time to do it, and then installing it on a couple of machines, rather than just fucking compiling it on all of them.
The moment of realisation I had with RPM was basically when you realise that it isn't actually about creating RPM so you can do RPM minus UVH. It's not about you installing packages. The point of RPM is so Red Hat can build, or originally Red Hat, can build distributions with it. So the process is that it kind of, they download the tarball from upstream, and then the RPM tool manages applying their patches and creating all of it. Does Deb work the same way? It means they only have to pull down the source code and then run their RPM, and it
sounds very similar in the fact. The one thing that I was surprised at was the fact that there really is an emphasis on keeping the core source tarball. So let's say ACK releases Jackfield, right, and releases a tarball, right? The emphasis is on leaving the tarball as pure as possible. So when you type in apt-get source Jackfield, as an example, if it was in the repositories, what that does is that downloads the source, it downloads the patches that are applied to that source, and it unpacks the source, and it applies the patches. So the source tarball that it downloads, which is known as the Aridge, it's got Aridge in the title.
It's like the ports tree.
Yeah, blah, Aridge.tar.gz is exactly the one that I would release on my website.
Yeah,
they don't give you the Debian patch source. They give you the original source and the Debian patches.
And then you get the patches. So that's great, because that means you can contribute those patches upstream. So for example, you know, everybody patches the release version. So, for example, you know, obviously Ubuntu is a derivative of Debian. Those patches get contributed upstream or side stream to Debian, or whichever stream you want to refer to it as. And then you apply those patches to the source package. And then that source package is just a packet. This is something I didn't know, is that it's a source package. And then you can use that to build multiple on different architectures and things like that, which is where things like PPA come in. And it's like ACK made the... is exactly, you know, hitting the nail on the head in the fact that a lot of these things are automated. So, for example, I was reading a little bit earlier on. Daniel told me to, informed me of a section in the packaging guide which shows you how to patch an upgrade of your source package. So, you know, let's say PTV 0.12.0 CBS2 comes out, and then it shows you how to update your source package, and then you can just rebuild it.
But presumably, is that just a basic case of downloading the TGZ file from the PTV website?
To be honest with you,
reapplying all your own. The command, does it just reapply?
I read it vaguely, but a lot of
that's
really
the point of the RPM is basically all they need to do.
If your patches still apply, then theoretically, packaging the new version is a question of downloading the new release, replacing the orig.tar.gz tarball, and then recompiling that into a binary package. In practice, your set of patches from against 0.11 might not apply in 0.12 because some of your patches might be integrated upstream,
but,
or they
but
might.
But if they do, then it is just a sort of a one line.
Yeah, Edward might have thrown away the whole model and done it all again from scratch. Again. Yes.
The other thing is that you get things like when I put my package online to show the people in the Motu channel, they said, you know, we'll also put on the, you know, the .dsc file, which is generated for you, which is used to build your binary package, and a couple of other files, like I think the original tarball and the patches one. So they could use that to see how the package works and then build it themselves. So they could give me advice. And of course, apt-get-source means that there's thousands of packages out there, all of which have got their control file. So I can look at those and learn from them as well. It's a system in which you can learn a lot about how packaging works. Yeah. There's so much prior art out there, which is what I really like. I mean, and I'm sure it's the same for Fedora with RPM.
But there is once you learn how to take them apart.
Yeah, I mean, you can run less on a Debian package and look what's in it. Did you know that?
Only because less has been poked to know about them.
I thought that was weird.
Yeah,
you run R to unarchive them, and then they're just two TGZ files.
Exactly, yeah. Debian packages and R archive for
RPM and CPIO ones.
GZIP tar archives.
I've got one more thing to add to this, really. Unless I'm wrong, which is quite possible, I think probably most distributions are absolutely screaming for packages because everybody likes more people helping. And I think it's probably, if you can get over the initial hurdle, it's actually not a bad way into getting involved with your distribution.
Well, this is the thing I was saying earlier on, is that I was surprised how unhardcore you need to be. I was convinced that you needed to be a programmer because you need to know how to apply patches and you need to know how to resolve patch conflicts and you need to do all this kind of stuff just to build a package. And you don't. You need to know.
I ought to point out before people start rushing towards this idea, that you get quite a big leg up by packaging something which is already packaged. If you had a package Pitivy from scratch, it would be quite a bit harder because you have to sit there and think about how to compile it. All that stuff's already written for
you. It wouldn't surprise me, though.
Although Pitivy's Python, so...
Well, a couple of packages in, I think... you know, you'd figure out... I mean, most packages... most software now is auto-tooled, so you can...
And there's stuff in certainly the Debian package build system to easily set up an auto-tooled package as a Debian package.
So the thing is, it did surprise me, and it is a great way to contribute for people I'd consider power users, people who are relatively technical but not programmers.
Especially since at the moment, I mean, we've talked about auto-package and downloading things from the website directly in the past and so on, but at the moment we're still oriented around you should be able to get every piece of software you ever wanted as a package from your distribution. Yep. In order to be in that position, we have to make sure that every piece of software that exists for Linux is packaged, and therefore we need packages.
I mean, obviously I'm biased because I'm part of the Ubuntu community, but the thing that also amazed me as well is, well, the thing that impressed me was just how helpful the people on Ubuntu-Motu are. And it's not just for me. I've noticed them talking to other people. I can imagine that there might be a bit of bias because I work at Canonical or I'm the community guy or whatever, so they might help me, give me a little bit more help than usual, but... They're a really helpful bunch, and Motu.
We're going to finger of God you if you use the community again.
And Motu is a great place to get started in this kind of stuff because there's a lot of documentation and help out there. So
one other very brief question: Debian have a thing called Lintian. I don't know whether it's still kept up to date, but it will look. It's basically like Lint, the C program. What Lint does for C, it looks through it and tells you whether you've done stuff right. Lintian does for Debian packages. It will say you've correctly created a control file, or you've missed this out of the control file and it needs it, or it'd be nice if you did it this way rather than this way. Does that exist for Ubuntu, and did you use it?
You use Lintian.
You do?
Yeah.
Lintian still exists, it's still maintained, and it's what you use.
In the packaging guide, it's basically at the end of the guide, and it says, run Lintian on your package, and...
It tells you everything you've done wrong.
Yeah, and that's cool. And there's little things like there's 822-date, or date minus capital
minus R,
which basically gets the date for your changelog file, so it's the correct format and stuff like that. There's loads of these little things that help you do it. But, interesting stuff.
I'd like people to... I mean, Debian, I think the repositories are pretty deep. I know there are packages that get orphaned every now and again, but I think one thing that always pisses me off about Fedora and SUSE and Mandriva is that the package repositories are so much shallower.
I sort of agree with you and sort of don't. The point is not that the repositories as a set are shallower, it's that there are 25 repositories. Debian has one repository, I mean, the thing is, and everything's in it. Whereas if you're with Fedora, you get...
Yeah.
You used to have core and extras, now you've just got... Fedora, but then you've still got to go to Livna to get
that's what I was going
to
say.
And,
I mean,
and so on.
But I was going to say, if there's something in one of those distributions that you use that you really wish was packaged and you just pissed off with having to compile it every time, I'd really like to think people would just go out and just have a crack at trying to package it themselves. Yeah,
that's the great thing. Again, slight bias, but that's the great thing about PPA, which for people who don't know what it is, it's basically a means of uploading a source package, and it builds it on a build machine. But what it does is it provides an apt repository for you, so people can subscribe to your repository. So someone would have their own PPA, and then you could play with your packaging and upload your package, and then people could subscribe to your PPA repository and then just install it from their Ubuntu system. And
assuming you've got a Launchpad account, or you're prepared to have a Launchpad
This is part of Launchpad. But that's nice, because it means it's easy to not only have a play with packaging, but you can also have somewhere where people can get your packages from as well.
What was the OpenSUSE one called?
The build service. I don't know how. I know nothing about how it compares.
As I understand it, it does exactly what PPA for Launchpad does. It lets you upload a SUSE RPM source package, and then it will build it, and it will build it on a number of different architectures and make those binary RPMs available to you.
Do any other distros do this?
As far as I'm aware, no. What other distros are there? I mean, there's only really realistically Fedora. Red Hat. And I don't think Red Hat have a build service.
They used to be Mandriva.
Ooh!
only joking.
So, it's time for the emails.
Time for the email! It's the Linux Action Show!
No! Stop taking the boot.
They put the boot in, didn't they?
They did, actually.
They did a little bit, but there you go. Whatever.
It's good fun, though.
It is fun. I exchanged a few emails with them, in which I said, I like your show, and they said, we fucking hate you.
Ah, well, there you go.
They didn't really. we're all friends.
I didn't think they would do, yes.
They're all good fellas, good
all
fellas.
All friends in the open source community,
like,
aren't we?
Hopefully they'll be coming to Lug Radio Live USA, actually.
Yeah, no, they're...
Because I'd like to hook up with them, but I'm...
Yeah. No, and I like this friendly rivalry that we've got. The email I said to them, you know, we both sort of said, you know, it's good to have this kind of thing going, so fuck you both.
No, go fuck yourselves. Enjoy.
It was all going so well until the last two sentences, wasn't it?
sorry about that. Shall I go?
Yeah, help yourself.
Email. Hey, folks, love the show.
Who's this from?
I'll get to that.
Do any
of you guys have any experience with the Nokia 770 or the N800?
I'll be a no then.
You had a 770, didn't you?
I had a 770 for
I've got a 770 and an N800.
Do you find them useful in any way? No.
They're nice to play with for about maybe 11 minutes. I've never really got on with gadgets. To be fair, I've never got on with gadgets, though, like
I'd probably get far as 25. What do you mean you've never got on with gadgets? I've never known anyone for buying gadgets like you.
Yeah.
You bought a stupid robot dog for £700.
Not once, but twice.
You bought it, then you sold it, then you bought it again.
I didn't say I don't buy gadgets, but I don't tend to use them that often.
To be honest,
I eBayed the dog 6 months later.
I think most gadgets tend to offer a lot and do very little, don't they, by the time you get them out of the box. Yeah.
So,
no then, to your question.
This chap really likes his Nokia 770, so, you know, good on you, enjoy that.
It doesn't say how long he's been using it for, it may only be 20 minutes. So.
He does say, by the way, and I do mean this in as loving and as kind a way as possible, your group photo on the website looks like it came from the scrapbook of a New Jersey hood.
Is that right?
So, thanks for that. He says, like I have room to talk, what with my name, I know you'll find some good laughs in there, but it's nothing I didn't hear already in school. And that's from Anthony Arse Features. So, thank you very much.
Thank
you very much, Tony. It was nice to talk to you.
No, his name isn't really Arse Features. John O'Bacon.
Sorry, I just had to check.
What was his name? Because I didn't see anything
Arse
funny.
Features.
And Anthony Passano. Anthony Arse Features. I had to fucking check that.
Moving on.
So we go in this way around or that way around?
That way around.
Which way?
No more fingers. No.
Okay.
You weird electric addict. Get on with it.
It's electric.
It's the proctologist.
The Lord of the Rings.
The Arse Bandit Extraordinaire. Sorry, Chris. Read your email.
I want to now.
Yeah, bandito.
Hide in the tournament, sulk.
You want to bugger my donkey?
Sorry.
Adam's donkey.
Moving on. We have one today.
Go on, let it
email from Dick Davies, basically talking about...
Dick Davies?
Davies, yeah.
No open source web apps for you, and no Pony either. Basically, he's talking about if company. Yeah, we were talking about whether companies wanted their own Gmail, and he says, well, if that idea held water, then the people would be producing closed source web applications like that to be able to package up and be sold to companies,
which they are.
I'm not aware of any, but then again, I don't know.
There are loads of closed source web applications. Loads. They're sold to the enterprise market, but there are loads. People sell wikis. It's insane. People will go and buy a wiki and pay a fortune for it. I'm thinking, why don't you use frigging MediaWiki? Yeah. People are mental. You know, there's loads of enterprise software stuff.
How can anybody say MediaWiki doesn't deploy?
Doesn't scale.
Doesn't scale, you know?
Yeah, well, basically what enterprise software people are selling you on is the fact that you can edit your documents in Word, for example, which obviously the MediaWiki people can care less about because they're looking for...
Did you know that OpenOffice saves the MediaWiki format?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
I'm sure someone's written a thingy that lets you tell it, my MediaWiki is here, and it will save directly onto your MediaWiki.
Will it automatically say Stuart Langridge is known for his advocacy of G-Edit on every page that you write?
Hopefully not.
You must be so proud.
I didn't write
He
that.
Wasn't known for many things, yeah, but his advocacy of G-Edit.
Advocacy of G-Edit.
Second to none. Bit of an arsehole, but...
Bit of an arsehole, but his G-Edit advocacy.
Thanks for that, G-Edit, you know. Matt Lee updated it, I think he removed that, and wrote my birthday in, which was nice of him. Got it wrong the first time, and then I corrected him.
I think the only thing he added to it as well was... He's known for his advocacy of free software or something.
It's better than G-Edit, for God's sake. Much as I like G-Edit, and it is the best editor in the world, as proved by the Lug Radio Finger of God earlier.
And there it is!
Moving on.
Okay, I've got one here from Wade Olson, and he's inviting us to the KDE 4 release event in Mountain View, California.
Very cool name, incidentally. Wade Olson.
Do you know who else I think has got a really cool name? Brandon Holtzclaw.
Yeah, Random
Holtzclaw. Random Coleslaw.
And he's got the best film American accent in the world.
He's crazy, and it's like, you got a real purdy mouth.
Real like people.
It's the problem. It sounds like something out of Deliverance. Yes.
So it looks like the KDE release event is from the 17th to the 19th of January, and he's inviting us to go at the California Hotel. More.
Yeah.
That'd be quite cool. I mean, it is... some considerable distance away from where we live.
We haven't really discussed whether we're going to go, but I know from a personal point of view, I find it very fucking unlikely that I'm going to be ponying up for a trip to Mountain View, California out of my own back pocket.
Didn't they say that they cover transport? Or is it accommodation?
No.
Hold on. It's quite a long email. I can't find that. Just look at the size of the font as well. So I'm not going to find that straight away.
Yeah. But notice how Langridge doesn't advocate the use of his pathetic Gmail printing emails out.
I have two things to say to you here. First of all, it automatically works out how big the font needs to be so it fits a reasonable amount of emails on a page.
Tight.
And secondly, feel free to do the emails your fucking self, Bacon. I haven't got a printer. He rings me up today and he says, I have to go and pay my car tax. It's actually late and they fine me. And I said, well, why didn't you do it a month ago when I told you to? And he says, well, do you think they'd accept a PDF of my insurance?
No, I'd
have to go down and show them a PDF on my laptop because I'm too tight to buy a printer for like £5 out of Crime Converters. Just go and buy a printer.
I'm not going to Crime Converters to buy a printer.
All right, go and buy a printer full price in a proper shop if you like, moron brain. Buy one out of Crime Converters. They cost nothing.
Moron brain. Are you six?
Okay.
Sorry, carry on.
I hope you've enjoyed yourself.
We'll hug later on. We'll always make up.
This is quite a small font, so I failed to find anything else in there that I can read out. But
losing your eyesight,
just a little bit. It's the only thing that works. Actually,
it's a pretty small font. To be honest with you, looking at it,
my cock went years ago. My eyesight's the only thing that works.
Didn't need to know that.
just one more little point out of here. I just noticed that Aaron Saigo is doing the keynote on the 18th of January, and I think Aaron Saigo did a fucking fantastic talk at Lug Radio Live. So
yeah, he's cool guy.
Worth seeing.
Good lad.
Very short guy. But he wasn't even the shortest person at Lug Radio Live, because we have both Matthew P. Revelle and Jerv.
wasn't Jerv stood on Matthew P. Revelle's shoulders to try and get in with a long macro and
get on the stage?
Still approximately as tall as Aaron.
It was great. We felt like we had Oompa Loompas around us. They should form some kind of, like, dancing troupe.
Our popularity with Saigo has just gone down about five notches. But
look, Radio, we'll welcome under 21s, but fuck you, short people.
fucking dwarves, fuck off. That sounds like a cool event. I'd be surprised if we travel all the way to Mountain View for it, to be honest with you.
But if we...
Bacon will probably be there anyway.
I don't know, I might be going. We'll see. Very short email and then a longer one. We've had an email from Joel McLaughlin saying there is Ubuntu. Ubuntu.org.
Ubuntu. Yeah, which is presumably an enlightenment version of Ubuntu.
Indeed.
We had a couple of people write in and say, oh, yeah, you said there's no easy way to test the enlightenment, but there's elivecd.org. And to those people, I would say, I went to the enlightenment channel and said, should I use elivecd? And they said, no, it's miles out of date.
Yeah.
I don't know whether Ubuntu is the same or not. Maybe it isn't. It would be nice if the Enlightenment people had mentioned it to me, but sadly they must have forgotten.
It's Ubuntu. When you switch it on, you run around a darkened room listening to repetitive music, munching on pills. It's great. The next email came from Matthew Davidson. Prepare for the boot, fellas.
Oh, it was this one.
Subject line: did Matt and Aid take Lug Radio's balls with them?
Which is nice.
They took Nan Friedman's. Hi, guys. I think I may have zoned out for a bit while listening to the last episode because you interviewed a free software developer who works for Novell just after Novell publicly boasted about how they're reprehensible. FUD. Deal with Microsoft had increased their sales. And at the end of the interview, I couldn't recall anybody asking a single question about it. That's because we were talking to Miguel.
No, Greg Crowerham.
Oh, no, that's the... He's Greg KH about. One.
Oh, no, he works for Novell, doesn't he? I assume he's referring to Greg KH.
Well, Miguel or Greg KH, don't believe either of them were responsible for the Microsoft deal.
I mean...
One thing, just to clarify, sorry to butt in, but one thing we try not to do on Lug Radio is to give someone who works for a company the boot for every possible misdemeanor that company may have done, because it's a bit mean. So we gave Miguel a kicking
and
for mono.
To be quite honest, every interview would be hours long if we covered every possible topic that involves their company. Yeah. So
that's the reason why. But
yeah, I mean, quite a lot of people have said, well, why didn't you stick the boot into Miguel about his comments on OpenOffice XML? And the answer was because we were talking about Moonlight.
Yeah. Just because Miguel's on, we're not going to hammer him on every single issue.
I don't particularly agree with Miguel on some of the stuff that he says.
Yeah.
But, you know, it seems unreasonable to... If someone says something wrong one time, you just lay into them forever about that one thing.
Sorry, one more point. I think if people have got suggestions about what they think we should be covering in the show, well, feel free to send them in. I mean,
We're on the Lug Radio forums at forums.lugradio.org. We've actually got a forum called Ideas for the Show, and we'd be interested to hear your ideas for the show. So if you'd like us to talk to Miguel and say... what about this OpenOffice XML thing? Or you'd like us to talk to this person or that person or the other person? Let us know. Do, please.
Well, Matthew P. Davidson goes on. He says, it also appeared that you didn't ask a single question about Miguel's assertion that Microsoft OOXML is a superb standard, contrary to the opinion of just about anybody who knows anything about it. Refer to Axe's statement of about 25 seconds ago. I know you can't possibly have made such glaring omissions because who on earth would want to hear an interview exclusively about Mono and Silverlight / Moonlight? Well, that's us. I've got three applications.
The OOXML thing, there was an interesting discussion about it on the... On the forums, again, actually, since I'm talking about the forums anyway.
It was a very interesting discussion.
I got into a fight with a few people about OOXML and ODF and so on, so
go and check it out. I've got three applications that depend on Mono on my desktop computer, two of which are installed by default in Ubuntu, and I never use, and the other...
I assume a Tomboy and Beagle.
And the other I installed out of curiosity, and I never use. I'm assuming that's F-Spot.
F-Spot's in by default, isn't it?
Of course it is, yeah.
So which one of Tomboy and Beagle
is
in by default?
It was a media player, I think.
Beagle isn't in by default.
It is.
Hang on, I'm getting to that. And I think you may have been interviewing the only person on the planet who thinks Silverlight is intended to be a serious product people actually use rather than a spoiler for other vendors' middleware platforms, which I will immediately cease development, which will immediately cease development should Microsoft win the Web 2.0 application framework wars. Oh! And on the subject of real-world users of Zool, there's also Miro, formerly Democracy Player. It's got the worst user interface I've ever seen.
He's a real happy guy, this
fellow.
He's,
yeah, he's a seething ball of hate.
He just sat on a fucking nail or something.
Sorry, I'm trying to pick out nice words. Formerly Democracy Player, it's got the worst user interface I've ever seen, but I use it because it's an adequate video podcast aggregator. In fact, I probably watch more video I've downloaded via Miro than I watch via broadcast television. Okay. That makes three Zool-based apps on my computer I use versus three mono-based apps I don't. Based on this highly dodgy sample size, maybe next episode's Mystery Hunt should be for mono. This guy got it in for Nivelle and the mono.
He's a real cup half full guy, isn't he?
I think he would be and soul of the party.
He makes a couple of semi-reasonable points, but the main one is that, as we said, we don't shoe someone for everything their company does whenever we speak to them.
The other thing I take a little bit of issue in this is the fact that he refers to FUD, right? Coming from Microsoft.
What's the thing I thought about something about that? Was it called something FUD? Was he exactly
reprehensible what? FUD.
Is that Elmer Fudd's brother?
He refers to a reprehensible FUD deal with Microsoft. But to be frank, the whole point of FUD is only ever providing one side of the viewpoint about something, and that letter is full of it about Nivelle. And, you know, it doesn't really show two sides. Yes, Nivelle made some bad moves, but also Nivelle have funded lots of upstream software development, some great work going on in various parts.
People, if you agree with, is it Andy Davidson?
No, it's Matthew Davidson.
Matthew Davidson. If you agree with Matthew Davidson, write in and tell us. If you agree with us, write in and tell us.
Yeah, but we appreciate the email, Matthew, and your thoughts. Absolutely.
We do, you know, I mean, write in and bollock us if you think so, or bollock us on our forums if you like.
Just on the thing about Silverlight and Moonlight, I think people should probably remember that this is, even though the show's called Lug Radio and the L means Linux, it's not just a Linux show. We talk about
all sorts of stuff.
It's open source, it's web technology, and all sorts of things.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And what we said earlier on as well, go to the forums, forums.lugradio.org, and post your ideas about what you want to see in the show. With season 5, we've wanted to kind of take more feedback from the forums. And one thing we're going to do, aren't we, Stuart Langridge?
Yes.
Is we're going to put in the show notes when we have the bits and pieces list in the show notes, there'll be a link to a thread on the forums, so you can go and discuss that particular topic in the forums. Absolutely. You two won't know about this because it was an idea that appeared about 2 o'clock this afternoon. about something completely different.
Something else, since we're talking about new ideas, and the people who wrote an email in this week will be quite sad about this. but we're sorry about that, because it probably would have gone to Matthew Davidson this week.
Yeah, you would have got it. Yeah.
As of next time, best email of the show, it's a special Lug Radio t-shirt. It's like Blue Peter, can you believe it? With the Blue Peter badges, all the Americans are going, what the fuck is Blue Peter? But you'll get a Lug Radio t-shirt for best email of the week. The reason we haven't done it at the moment is that we don't have any Lug Radio t-shirts yet.
While we're on the topic, at the risk of causing information overload, while we're on the topic of all stuff to do with you getting in touch with us, one thing we've been thinking about doing is, if you're actually doing something interesting to do with Linux and open source or free software or anything that we would be interested in hearing about, if you let us know, we may well, like the fellow from Mandriva, we may well interview you.
Absolutely.
So please get in touch if you're actually doing something we'd like to talk to us about.
Yeah, we should clarify that we don't just want to interview rock stars. We don't just want to interview people who are really famous and well known. We want to interview people who are doing interesting stuff. So if you're running a free software project that's doing something new and different, or if you're involved in an advocacy effort, or you've had a weird experience or whatever, get in touch and send us an email to show@lugradio.org and we'll check it out.
Absolutely.
The requirement is you own a phone. None of this voice over IP nonsense.
Oh, speaking about phones and voice over IP, which is not nonsense.
unless you're bold networking,
we have been left a voicemail, but importantly, you too can leave us voicemails. If you look at lugradio.org/contact, it has our voicemail number, but you can also ring up with a SIP phone completely for free over the internet. Yes, indeed. So you don't have to pay anything. If you're in America, you might find it easier than ringing an international number and paying for it.
Should we listen to the voicemail message that we received?
We should, though.
Here we go.
How do Lug Radio types? This is Neuro from Hashlug Radio in London Lab. Just wanted to say good effort on reaching season 5. Seems like forever since your first episode. I am just totally stoked about the idea of Lug Radio Live US taking the Lug Radio ethos to the wilds. I was going to say, like, missionaries to dark lands that don't get open source, but I think Silicon Valley gets it. Anyway, keep up the good work, yada yada yada. Hurry up and get Mr. Ben on the show to do an update on what he's doing as Community Hero. Mad props to Jono for being a top Linux blogger. And I'll speak to you soon. Toodles!
There we go. Nero, we love the man.
We do. Thank you very much, Nero.
That was
Haggis eating bastard that he is.
To be honest, I thought that was a really nice, heartfelt
message. It was, actually.
I put a real smile on my face when I heard that. Yeah. So,
thank you, pal.
Yeah. So it's
good stuff. So, send us more voicemails. Go to lugradio.org/contact and look at the number.
Because
we don't know what it is.
it's got 5 at the end. I can never. That's why I wrote it down, for God's sake.
And we'll consider the voicemails with the emails as to which one is the best one for the T-shirt.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
it's opening the door, the floodgates of the freak size.
Bring it on, freaks. We are not afraid. So if any give us too much lip, we'll come and put the Lug Radio finger of God on.
It is a disastrous device. So so we're done.
I think that wraps it up.
Thank you, and see you next time.
See you next time.
Bye-bye.